I do not know whether I deserve all these tributes that have been paid to me, but I am grateful for the affection and appreciation. Today I have been asked to speak, according to the program, on the true values of life. And everyone who has spoken has given his or her own ideas on the subject and different aspects of their thoughts and activities. But how can one really give the true value of life, true values in life? Because are we such great experts to know what is the highest and the best? Are we equal to many of the great ones who have shown us the pathway and who have shown us the way of learning and wisdom and love? We are not equal to them. And so it seems to me rather presumptuous, I will say on my part, to tell you what are the true values of life, except to think in terms of example, because according to me, example is the only way to show to the world what is truth and what is beauty and what is of permanent value. True values of life may mean many things that we value, but that which dies, that which is transient, cannot be true. But there are certain things which are of such value that it is unchangeable. Truth never changes. What is true thousands of years ago essentially is true today. And it is the same, it will be the same forever and ever and ever. So it is difficult for us to express that eternal value which is incomprehensible by the lower mind. Our minds cannot really fathom the full truth and the greatness of experience that have been shown to us from time to time. Great avatars have come into the world. Great sages have come into the world. The great mystics have come into the world, each one to show to humanity as apparently a new way of life. But in reality, there is no new way. It is only the old way, the true way, put in a new form. If a great one speaks in the Sanskrit language, and you put the same thing in the English language, does it become new? No. The language becomes new, the form becomes new, but the truth does not become new. It is always there. So therefore we have to think in terms of those ideas which are absolutely essential to us and essential to life. In the Theosophical literature as well as in the Gita, we talk about the three gunas, the three paths, the jnana marga, the karma marga and the bhakti marga. Of course, we can all say I belong to this marga, that marga, the other. But they are all absolutely intertwined, and therefore you cannot say what. There is only the Satya Marga, the true Marga. And that what we have to follow. And this morning, Peter Mayer Doane talked about art and beauty and explained to us very beautifully what he felt. Of course, beauty and art, it's also truth, truth in form. It is also truth that we experience. But I would like very much to emphasize the fact that a very great importance is that of bhakti. He said, I am a bhakta. And I've heard one or two other people say to me, that's my line. And I was rather pleased, because in this age of intellectual conjuring with ideas, a simple approach is very rare. And actually, the bhakti marga, the devotion marga, is a very simple approach, and it is the greatest stimulant to our inner natures. We have, of course, that devotion in every religion, and every great teacher evokes that devotion, because true devotion is really love. We talk about love, you're loving the universe, loving people, loving children, loving people, and falling in love and all those things. But if you fall in love with a great being and you have devotion, that is the highest love of all. And that highest love stimulates us to other forms of love in its truest sense, not the transient sense. There are many, many illustrations of this bhakti, which is a very important thing, particularly in this present age. Because the mind and intellectual approach is, of course, remarkable, it's wonderful, but it has to be refined, purified, and deepened by wisdom. And that depth of wisdom can come only through the emotion, which is evoked by devotion. And emotional approach is a very important thing. And that approach is natural to us, because all people are emotional. But the kind of emotion does not produce much result, because very often it is turned to oneself. Emotion affecting one's own happiness, one's own thoughts, one's own desires, etc. Now in the field of art and religion, which I consider to be one and the same essentially, there is, of course, a very great experience of this devotion. And I think I can say to you that as far as I am concerned, if I have created anything that is worthwhile in art, it is because of that devotion. Because it has stirred in me such love, such admiration, such sense of beauty, that automatically the creative spirit becomes dominant. When I was, I'm going to tell you in a very informal way, because you had many very powerful speeches, and I would like just to make it in terms of my experience. The whole of India the keynote of the country is essentially a country of devotion. There is, of course, learning. There is a remarkable, powerful expression of many vast subjects, like even astronomy, mathematics, and everything else. But all is allied to the religious spirit. And therefore, you can't separate all those from art either. Because art is an expression by which you contact the same spheres of cosmic consciousness that you contact through science or through yoga or any other way. And so, art has played a very important part in Indian life in the expression of devotion, because if you say, well, I am devoted, what do? You just sit and meditate, how long? But if you sing it, you can sing forever. If you create a picture, you can create beauty forever. If you can dance and express in movement, you are transported to another world by which all physical fatigue, physical muscular effort, physical experiences even disappear and melt into a greater experience of lightness, which is dance. The great conception of Nataraja, the king of dancers, the yogi of yogis, is a very, very remarkable conception, Shiva. And even when you go today to a temple like Chidambaram, you see that image, that marvelous statue with all the symbolism, with all the occultism, with all the beauty of the dance and all the arts, and yet elevated to a cosmic level. He is the cosmic dancer. In this Chidambaram temple, I can tell you an experience, because I think experience is the best way to tell a story. When I gave dance performances, I wanted to dedicate myself in that temple. Dr. Arundale was very keen about it. And nobody is supposed to dance in that temple except the Lord of the dance. No human being was supposed to dance there at all, because there is only one dancer, one performer there, that is Shiva. And in spite of it, the priest requested me to come and give a dance program in that temple. And we did it secretly so that crowds of people won't come. Many of us went there, musicians and all. But like all secrets, it was known in every village round about. And I had invited about 10 people only, great people, who came rushing out and said, don't go in, don't go in, the crowd is impossible. But I had come and I decided I am going to dedicate myself, my work and everything. So we went in by the side door. There were about 5,000 people there in that courtyard, in that temple. 5,000 people at least. And no police knew that such a crowd was going to come. And so on. And the priests were all sitting around. There was the image of Nataraja. And the atmosphere was something tremendous. It was something so uplifting. I lost the musicians, because in the crowd, they were here, there, everywhere. I could not see them. Dr. Arundel was sitting here and another Sanskrit scholar was sitting there. I had a space about 20 to 30 feet, but I ended up in having only 8 feet because the people are pushing. And so I told the musicians above the crowd, start the music. And they did. And I performed one dance, by which time the crowds are pushing in still further. And when I finished the dance and went away, then I was asked, what was your experience? This is what I want to say. Because the entire floor is covered with granite, very hard stones, not even. And of course it was going to be very difficult to do, even with one dance of dedication. But you will believe it or you don't believe it, but it means something to me and may not be to you, I don't care. The musicians were singing from somewhere, I heard the music, I never saw them. But the actual experience was that I was dancing on a bed of roses, not on stone. It was such extraordinary, divine atmosphere in that place. That was the greatest moment of my life. Then I thought to myself, yes, if your art is dedicated and you are full of devotion and you are uplifted, even the physical body becomes non-physical. Even the stone becomes a flower. That was what the lesson I learned. And that's why I'm saying devotion can perform magic. Such remarkable things in everybody's life. This magic is a thing which has to be experienced by each one of us. There are many, many stories of devotion in our country. And combined with great philosophy. You see, every time I produce a play, I learn something. One was the story of Shiva. And it is a play composed by a very, very great immortal poet called Kalidasa, called Kumarasambhavam. And in that Kumarasambhavam, he was composing the dance. The story is Parvati, the consort of Shiva, the goddess of the mountains, Uma. She sees Shiva meditating and she wishes to be married to him. She takes flowers, lotus flowers, makes garland of lotus seeds and offers it to him. At the moment that she offers, comes Cupid, because he had been sent by Brahma to go and disturb the meditation of Shiva, who, if he falls in love with Parvati, will come a divine child into the world, Subramanya, the Lord of the world. These are all symbolic, because Shiva represents the sun and Subramanya represents the Lord of the world as we know it in the Theosophical Society. And when Cupid appears, Shiva opens his third eye and reduces him to ashes. And Parvati goes disappointed because Shiva does not look at her with eyes of love. So she discovers something else, that her love must be different. So she comes later with the cloth, bark of the tree, cloth made of the bark of the tree, and with beads for worship, very simple, with all devotion, and does penance. And when she does penance, and her devotion is complete, and her aspiration to become united with Shiva is great and pure, then, for the story is long, I'll make it short. He comes to test her and says, as a Brahmin, and says to her, why are you wasting your body this way? Your bridegroom wears anklets, bracelets of serpents, ashes on his body, his hair is uncombed, and he has got 3 eyes instead of 2. But such a person, why do you aspire after him? Then she gives a very beautiful description of what it all means and says to the Brahmin, you don't understand Shiva, you don't understand him. Because he is too beyond our conception, and explains the meaning of all. That would make a whole evening, so I won't tell you. So anyhow, when she has answered and sends this Brahmin away, really Shiva appears and then takes her hand, and the marriage of Shiva takes place, which is of course symbolic, because in our conception, mother and father, man and woman, the goddess and the god, they are all one, because we are all a dual in reality. But it is devotion that won him, not the charms of the physical life and all those things. So it has, like this, there are so many stories. Stories of value to us in our daily life even. Sri Krishna in the Gita Govindam and so on. He is playing with the gopis. Gopis represent humanity. And Radha, the great gopi, who loves him, sees him playing with the gopis and is jealous and goes away and won't talk to him. Then her friend comes and tells Krishna that she is longing for you. You must come. But when he comes, she rejects him, saying, I don't want you. She rejects him. Then what does he do? But she is a great devotee. And the divine being is not the only person to whom you are devoted, but he is devoted to the devotee. And so he says to her, put aside your pride. The self aside and forget yourself in me. Lose your love without that selfish wish. Of course, it's all in beautiful songs. I can't sing it now. And so, finally, he teaches her, and he, what does he do? She, a disciple who falls at his feet, the Lord, instead of that, he falls at her feet. He falls at her feet because she represents devotion, pure devotion. He respects that devotion even in the commonest person and pays homage to the ordinary being because of that quality within. Now the great ones always see the quality in the person in spite of all the defects, and they pay homage to that quality and respect to people when there is sincerity, when there is devotion, when there is unselfishness, and when there is true love. These are exemplified in the forms of many, many stories. I cannot tell you how much, how many stories, it's unending. How many songs, it is unending. And Krishna is of course the divine example for us all of true devotion and beauty. Because a great one and his greatness of character and his beauty is combined into one. You can't separate beauty from greatness. You can't separate beauty from character. So therefore you find in the Ramayana description of Rama, how beautiful his face was, what complexion he had, what beautiful walk there was, what beautiful speech there was. So in the same way, Krishna's charm won the hearts of all people, and they fall at his feet because of their love for him, which he evoked by his example, by his life. Now these are all very, very beautiful thoughts. And in the Gita too, and in the Mahabharata, at a time comes, Krishna plays a very important part as an ambassador, trying to make peace between the Pandavas and Duryodhana, the selfish person, and pleads and pleads and pleads to give them their land. And no matter how much, give one, five houses? No. One house? No. Finally he said, not even the space for a pin will I give to the Pandavas. That is the first starting of the great war. But they are both devoted to him, both the enemy and this. They both want Krishna, because nowhere Krishna is there, there is success. But he put them to the test. One of you can have me with no arms. I will not fight, just me alone. And one of you can have all the army and all my wealth and all my land, my entire kingdom. Which do you choose? Of course, Duryodhana chose all the possessions. But Arjuna, the true devotee, who was unswerving in his loyalty, he said, I want you alone. I want nothing else. So Krishna becomes Partha Sarathi. That means, Sarathi means the charioteer of Partha, of Arjuna, and stays behind and gives him the great teaching of the Gita, which was the very greatest book, greatest teaching that we can have in the world. So all our teachings are in the form, some are in form of stories, some are in form of actual historical people. Historical people. And these examples are the best ways for us to know the true value of life. What is the truest thing? When I say devotion, it doesn't mean just sitting and praying, no. But showing it in action, how you can live according to that devotion. What you can do in life. This applies to Sri Krishna, this applies to the teaching of Sri Rama, this applies to the Christ. You can put different names that you like, but the value of life is the action. And that is the value from which we can learn how we are two in the world, two different kingdoms of nature, two different people, and in all our lives. How we, each one can be a magnetic center, a great magnetic center. And of course, many of us who became members of the Theosophical Society, were we attracted to the truths that were taught in the Theosophical, through Theosophy? Perhaps to Western people, reincarnation, the idea of karma, all these things must have been a great revolution, revolutionary ideas. Life after death, that people really do not die, and all these things. But in the Eastern world, it is not that. It is not that, but it is the living reality and the presence of great ones in the world. That which was presented meant most and evoked again, once again, a magnificent feeling of devotion and reality which brought into our minds something so true. An ideal person, an ideal man, an ideal woman, like whom we can be, like whom we can live. This is a very wonderful wonderful truth as far as I am concerned, because I knew about reincarnation, I knew about all that, brought up in it. So what is it? What was the new? Nothing. But the great teachers of humanity, the masters, who they are, what they are, how they lived, this truth was the reality. And that reality is something, if it is a real experience, you cling to it. You can't shake it off. Nobody can shake you away from that particular reality. And that is the way I feel we have to be. If we really want to know the truth, it must be this unshakable experience which lives with you in this life as well as in the lives that are to come. And that must influence our action. And our action is the only way by which we can show to the world not only what is truth, what is truth, what is beauty, and how do we show it? In all ways. Of course, the great experience of love, which has been talked about, we all know about it, of course, is important, because we can't do anything without love. That transcends all. That transcends all differences, that transcends all hatred, that transcends all bitterness and all ugliness. And because where there is no love, there is only ugliness. And so that does transcend, but that also is shown only by example. And I think if we read stories, even more than merely teachings, we learn something from these stories and from these examples. When a woman came because she was a prostitute and was brought before the Christ, and the Christ said, let him that is without sin throw the first stone at her. What a wonderful experience, what a wonderful expression. And yet, we can criticize, we can say so. And like this, you see many examples. The very presence of a great one, if he is lived, becomes him completely whole from top to bottom, something marvelous and wonderful. Like even the animals can recognize that. Sometimes animals can recognize greatness better than human beings. Many people dislike the Buddha, some even wanted to, because they thought he was working against the Hindu religion. And you know the story, don't you, of the elephant that went to attack him. Well, what did the elephant do? His face and his beauty was such, and the atmosphere was such, that it knelt down and bowed before him instead. And so, it's the human beings that have all the complications. We can also learn a lot from the animals. I always say, the animals have very few wishes. They want only love and food. We want love, food, possessions, pleasures, and thousands of other things. They are complicated. So we have to be made simple again. And I think the pure devotion and love can make us simple again, make us into people who are deeply experienced in wisdom and yet simple and natural, completely natural. This, I think, is the great lesson that we can learn from all the great ones of India. In our dances, we are very fortunate, and because we know so many beautiful stories, and when we dance them, we live them. For the time being, if I dance the dance of Krishna, I become Krishna. And if I dance the dance of Radha, his consort, then I become Radha. And for some time, you are that person. So it's a very beautiful experience. In the same way, with regard to music too, so many of our great musicians, they have sung songs on Rama and Krishna, and many saints have sung, Sufis have sung, all sing the praise of the Lord. And such wisdom also you get. There is a very beautiful song by Sri Tyagaraja, very great saint and musician. And he sings a song which is very famous, Sakkani Raja Margamu. He says, when there is a royal road, Santula Dura Melara, why does your mind go into bypaths and all these narrow, dirty lanes? Let your mind go through the royal road, and that royal road leads you to the feet of Rama, is it? So you can see these songs of devotion allied to the beauty of sound and the beauty of form together makes that which we call great art, but not the art of the artist who creates a picture or composes a song, but the artist who becomes himself the work of art. That is the final ideal regarding art, that by which you identify yourself so much with beauty that you become a work of art. You don't create a work of art, but you are created as a work of art. You become the work of art. And that idea inspires me very, very much. And of course, you have to enter into the spirit of it all in order to get that experience. When you take a dance and it describes Krishna, there are so many thousands of songs. I think Sridevi is going to sing something tomorrow. Well, Krishna, he is so very beautiful. He is dark and he is beautiful. And he is in Vrindavan and he is playing with the gopis. And he is dancing because he evokes devotion out of playfulness and charm. And the gopis and the mother forgets. He is a naughty child like any other child. He steals butter and many things. But she goes to scold him, but she can't. Because the divinity in him is such that it completely changes her. So in the forest, the Vrindavan, the gopis go, and the cows are there, and the peacocks are playing. The cows go to drink water, because of the Yamuna river, because it's dark water. But when they go near, they see Krishna. It's his body that they see. That beautiful, dark, divine body. And so when the gopis go to decorate their ears with the flowers from that tree, they think, well, let's go to that tree. And the tree is great. When they go, they discover it's not the tree, but it is Krishna. And in the same way, you see the peacocks looking up into the sky, seeing the dark clouds and looking for the water. Again they see Krishna. All creatures see him, that divine being, everywhere. It is to teach a lesson of that spirit of oneness and beauty that I think great ones come into the world from time to time. Only thing is, our memories are so short that they have to come again and again and again to remind us. But how do they remind us? Is it by teaching or is it by living? If it is only by teaching, then its words are enough. But it's only by living comes the teaching. And then we see how to live. And we can learn from that the high principles and values of life, which are not solemn and solid. It was mixed with happiness, it was mixed with normal life, it was a human life, humanity was understood, human weaknesses were understood. But essentially the greatness within each one, that is understood. So it is described that he to whom we offer devotion is himself a devotee. He is devotee of the humanity, of the goodness that is in the heart of each one of us. And that is a very beautiful thought. I am only saying this to show that since we have been talking about art and about myself and Kalakshetra and so on, how I learnt many lessons through art. How many beautiful thoughts have come to me by these experiences, by the creative art, and by the lives of great ones who are our examples. And you don't talk about being old-fashioned, it's out of date. Nothing true is ever out of date. I can't ever appreciate that. Way of putting it may be out of date, but never what is true. And finally, that ideal of devotion expresses itself in your own life when you are work of art and you can become not just a perfect person, somebody who has attained moksha or attained nirvana. I am not interested in attaining nirvana or in attaining moksha. But the greatest moksha is that, or nirvana, is when you can give that happiness and that consolation and that comfort and that love to all around you. This is the final detachment. And it is, if this is aroused in each one of us, and if we, I am telling you what I feel for myself. If I can do this, by which I forget myself because of everything around me, if I can learn this lesson of that which is beautiful in each individual and in life, and can bring turn this sorrow into a great force of a blessing and benediction to the world, then I feel I have understood all the teachings that I've had through the Theosophical Society, through the great books in our society, through the great sages of India, through the great sages of the West. No matter where there was greatness, from that I have learned this lesson, by which I can transmute the I-ness into, what I say, you-ness. That is the important thing. I feel, it says in our great learned people say, in the Kali Yuga, the keynote is the devotion, bhakti, and also action. I think that seems to be very, very true. And this has to be the keynote that will balance the many things, other things, approaches that we are having. And the lessons that we want to teach others, I think, is not so important as the lessons that we learn from others. I wanted to say something that is deep in my heart and different perhaps from what you might have expected of me, but also to show you that just art is not just a little pleasant, beautiful thing that you appreciate, but it has got a very deep, revolutionary side which will revolutionize our lives. And I think I can say it has revolutionized my life. Thank you.
May we go out of this hall without speaking and think something of what she's been giving us tonight. I say to Rukmini, God bless you and spare you to inspire us for many years to come.